Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and these are Daniel Howitt's interviews with the cinematographer for the wonderful story of Henry Sugar, Robert Yeaman, and short film's costume designer, Kaisha Walika Maimon.
Good evening, Mr. Sugar,
said the man behind the desk whose job it was to never forget a face.
Henry Sugar was 41 years old, unmarried and rich.
Strange.
The following is what Henry read in the Little Blue Exercise Book.
Gentlemen, I am a man who can see without using his eyes.
He saw it, I cried. He saw that trolley. This is absolutely unbelievable.
I was flabbergasted.
Robert, thank you so much for taking time to chat with me about the wonderful story of Henry Sugar. I'm always thrilled to see what you and Wes cook up. So I'm glad we got the chance to talk today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, Henry Sugar has such a distinct look, even for a Wes Anderson film. It's very different. Where did you get started when you came onto this project? Where do you and Wes, what's the beginning of your collaboration?
Well, you know, it's obviously a script, you know, and he sends me the script. And then Wes, you know, in the last few movies, he makes an animatic, which is like a little cartoon. And that's kind of an ongoing process. But, you know, by the time we start prepping the movie, it's a guide for everyone, the art department and the camera department in particular, you know, in terms of, because so much of it was, I mean, the whole thing was built on a stage, you know, and so the art department has to know what it is he's going to want to be seeing. So that's how it starts, with a lot of art department type things and going over just the physicality of it and how are we going to do this. As you know, if you saw it, you know, the walls are sliding and how are we going to pull all this off? And so we kind of break down each shot and discuss. It's kind of a collaboration between the art department and the camera grip electric department and how we're going to physically pull this off. And then we also get into more of the aesthetics of it, you know, with not only just physically how we're going to do it, but what's it going to look like and what's the best way to achieve that, what Wes is going for in his vision. So there's a lot of nuts and bolts type things that have to happen first. And then we get into more of the finer points as we progress through the nuts and bolts and how we're going to do this. Yeah. You know, with every Wes movie, there's a lot of testing that goes on beforehand. And, you know, we always try to test anything out that we at all have any doubt about. We test it beforehand and work out all the kinks before the actors show up, so that when the actors are there, we don't have to try to figure things out on the fly. So,
yeah, I read that you shot this on 16 millimeter. Is that right?
Yes.
Awesome. And what led you to 16 millimeter? Why was that the choice? I'm curious what cameras and lenses you chose
for. Well, we always shoot film. Wes is a film person, and you know, I think not only does he prefer the look of film, but just the process of shooting film is different than the process of shooting digitally. And you know, we had shot 16 on Moonrise Kingdom, and 16 has a particular quality to it that is different than 35 millimeter or digital cameras. And I think because this is kind of a throwback to another period, Wes felt that that look would be very appropriate to this film. And I personally love 16 millimeter. So when he said he was thinking about it, I was thrilled. And we use Arri cameras, the 416 and Zeiss lenses. I like when we shoot 16, I like to get the sharpest image I can. And the Zeiss lenses are very sharp and they're very good. And though we did on Poison, we had anamorphic lenses, and those were they're Hawk lenses, and those were the 16 lenses we got, and anamorphics, but the rest of it was shot with the Zeiss lenses, but yeah, the Hawks. And they're one of the few companies that makes 60 millimeter anamorphic lenses. And it was quite a struggle for us to get them because everybody wants them, you know, but somehow we were able to land them. And we were very excited, both Wes and I, to shoot 16 millimeter anamorphic for Poison, you know, not Henry Sugar, but for Poison. So, yeah.
Well, like you said, the staging of these shorts, especially Henry Sugar, is so complex. The moving pieces tied to the camera moves. Did you need more camera rehearsals than you typically do to get these moves right? Or was this kind of par for the course?
Well, because basically we were shooting in Maidstone, which is in England. It's about an hour outside of London. And it was an old television studio that had two, say, medium-sized stages. And so while we were shooting on one stage, the art department was building the other sets on the other stage. And so a lot of it kind of required putting track down for the camera and then also tracks for the moving sets. So the track for the camera would have to go underneath the tracks for the sets, you know, so a lot of that had to be worked out before we even got there. And so oftentimes after work, say we're on stage one, we're shooting all day, we go to stage two and we kind of spend a half hour there kind of working things out so that it can be prepared. So when the actors show up, like I said earlier, there's no guesswork. It's all, a lot of it is just done, and you know, and it was a beautiful system, but having the two stages literally, you know, 2 minutes walked from one to the next. So we could, you know, and Wes could look at the art direction and, you know, set design and make his comments, and they would have time to make those changes while we were shooting on the other set. So it was a really kind of efficient way of working, and you know, allowed us plenty of time. And it's in all Wes's movies, you know, when we construct things on set, you know, after work we always go over there and look at them and discuss things, and Adam Stockhausen, our production designer, always comes and you know, it's always kind of the three of us kind of huddle and talk about how we're going to do it, and what I might need from Adam or what Adam might need from me, you know, to pull off the shots, because we do, you know, again, we have that animatic, which is kind of our guide, which we kind of pretty much all Wes's movies now stick pretty to that animatic. So,
yeah, I was really curious about the relationship between you and Adam because of how intertwined the production design is to the shots on this film. Especially, I think of when the Yogi or Henry Sugar are supposed to be levitating and they're sitting on the box, you know, painted to match the background.
Yeah.
How did those? Was it a chicken and egg situation of who did you place your shot first, or did they design it in such a way?
They designed it, and then we had to kind of line it up, you know, and find the, you know, exact angle. I mean, obviously, you know, typically Wes in those situations likes the actor to be centered, so we would go beforehand and look at kind of where it would be, so the art department could paint it specifically so it blended into the background. So those are situations that we would definitely go beforehand and mark where the camera was. And we'd even take the camera with us and take a picture off the video assist. You know, it's film, but we have a little video assist monitor. And then Adam would know exactly where it was going to be placed. And then he and his artists could you know, just put it there and just really blend it in. And then sometimes it required a little finessing with the lighting to try to make it blend in a little easier. But, you know, you know, they would sometimes, you know, the shadows and things like that, that we had to kind of work out. But that was kind of, that wasn't super difficult, but it was more just, where is it going to be and how is it going to be painted so it blends in perfectly? So we have to really, I mean, the height of the camera, you know, that has a lot to do with it, and left, right, up, down. And so we really have to plan that very specifically. And so in all those cases, that's, we would go beforehand and with the camera, set it up. This is what we're going to do. And then Adam would use that as a template for creating that space.
Mm. Those moments are so cool. And the way your shots move in and out of the production design is just really fascinating.
Yeah.
The color of the film is obviously very specific as well. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you approached the color of Henry Sugar. There's the deep warmth of the Roald Dahl sequences, you know, the kind of cooler tones of the Ben Kingsley story and shifting color tones for the Benedict Cumberbatch sequences. Yeah. How did you approach the color of Henry Sugar?
Well, I mean, that was something that the three of us kind of batted around a little bit in prep. And I know the Roald Dahl office where Ray Fiennes was very carefully copied of his actual office. So that kind of determined the colors in there, I think. You know, they were, Wes has been to that office and we've seen a million pictures of it. And they even went and got some of the actual props that were there, you know. I mean, they really tried to replicate it as realistically as possible. You know, when we got into the casino part, we wanted to leave the exterior, have a very different feeling than the interior. And so Wes really pushed me, like when Benedict Cumberbatch comes into the main lobby there, to leave it really kind of a cold feeling to it. And then when we go into the casino and the walls, you know, apart, so we can kind of pass into that, he wanted to have a very warm kind of, you know, feeling, just to counteract, you know, be a different than what that lobby was. So we really, you know, pushed the color on that much more than I ordinarily would. But it's you know, it's kind of a fantasy. And I think he wanted, I think as Wes has progressed as a director and have done these animated films, it's really affected how he's doing his live action films now. And in some sense, these are, even though it's live action, they're kind of animated at the same time, you know. I mean, and he always prefers to do it kind of more of a homemade way than as, you know, something very slick CG, you know. He wants to see the nuts and bolts of it all, you know, and give it that kind of texture, I think, to the overall image. So
yeah,
that was something that we played around with too.
Yeah, that specific shot that you're referencing in the casino, the color shifts mid-shot from the warm to the cooler tones. What was that, to heighten that kind of handmade or stage sort of image?
Yeah.
What was the thinking behind that?
I think it was to heighten that, and also, again, because it's kind of a cartoon, you know, he wanted to really you know, take it to that level, so it wasn't realistic, it was more you know, fantastic in how we did it. And, you know, I think that was kind of our guiding light through all these things, you know, to take it off, you know, just take, it wasn't real. It was, you know, a hyper reality or whatever, however you want to say it. And so we would always kind of push things a little bit from a color standpoint and sometimes in a lighting standpoint and with the camera. I mean, you know, every one of those sets were just so constructed very carefully to reflect the animatic.
Yeah, like you said, it's this hyper reality, you know, filmed as if it's almost a stage production. There's one specific shot I'd love to ask about.
Sure.
Because most of the film is presented front facing, you know, as if it's as if we're the audience looking at a stage production. There's only a few other shots that have different angles. In the casino, you're shooting down. Roald Dahl, you shoot from two angles. But I noticed that there was, unless I missed something else, I only noticed one single reverse shot flipping the audience's perspective. That was when in the hospital with Dev Patel and Ben Kingsley, it's almost entirely that front facing shot. And then you turn the camera around for just one split, almost a split second. I was curious if you remembered that specific shot or the decision to turn the camera around just that one time.
Is it, was it in the little the waiting room kind of thing?
It was in the, it was in, yeah, the waiting room when where Ben Kingsley first enters the hospital and is kind of showing that he can see without his eyes, and yes. Dev Patel is sort of realizing that he's telling the truth. It's that sort of moment.
Yeah, you know, I don't. Yeah, I remember that. I know that they did a lot of things where they would turn to camera.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, it was very unusual. And address the camera to say the lines. And it was a very kind of unusual idea that I've never really seen before. And I think what Wes was going for, and he, you know, I talked to him about this a little bit, that when he first started adapting this whole story, because he was a Roald Dahl fanatic as a kid, you know, it was like he decided he didn't want to change the words, you know, because the words were so important. And to him, writing is such a sacred, you know, part of filmmaking. And so he came up with the idea that the actors would just say the words, you know, and let the words express it. And so maybe that was the idea there, was just, you know, again, I don't know, you know, why we turned the camera around, but it was a very kind of unique and bold decision to make. And I, you know, honestly, when I first heard that that was what he wanted to do, I was a little skeptical of it. And I was going, okay. I mean, Wes has presented crazy ideas to me in the past before. At first I would be skeptical. And then when I would actually see it, I would say, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes, you know, I love it, you know? And so there was a lot of that for me, you know, at first. And we did Henry Sugar, the first thing was what we shot of all the stories. And, you know, so right away, we jumped right into it. And at first, I was like, oh, is this going to work? Or, you know, but then when I saw the actors actually doing it with their expressions and their intonations, and obviously we had this amazing cast, you know, it kind of gave it some life that, you know, I didn't anticipate. And I saw right away, oh, this is going to be very cool, you know? And so I got on board with it really quickly. But as I said, this isn't the first time Wes has come up with some crazy idea that I at first thought, oh my God, you know, I don't know about that. But then when, you know, that's why he's Wes Anderson, you know, so.
Totally. Yeah. I was curious what sorts of visual references you guys shared to sort of develop the look of the piece. Was there any inspiration you had?
Well, he had, you know, pictures of the jungles and you know, things like that. You know, the whole sequence when Sir Ben goes through the jungle, and he always has visual references, and then, you know, and colors. I mean, he and Adam work a lot of that out, and you know, costumes. I mean, he's very specific about pretty much everything. I mean, every prop, every, you know, anything that comes on camera is kind of past his scrutiny. So, you know, a lot of it comes out of his head. And, but it wasn't like when we did Asteroid City, there were a lot of movies that we watched, Bad Day at Black Rock, Ace in the Hole, Paris, Texas, you know, that were, we referenced those types of movies. But we really didn't have that on this one. And, because we kind of jumped right into it. Because after Asteroid City, literally, I came home for like a month, and then I went straight to England, you know. And he had kind of, this is the thing that had been percolating in his brain for quite some time, I think. And he was wanting to just jump right into it. And so that's kind of how we did it, you know. I mean, it wasn't like we spent a lot of time watching movies together and talking about it, you know. It was... they start building the sets, and Adam would have, you know, he'd make pictures of what he was thinking, and Wes would make adjustments to it, and I would throw my two cents in, and, you know, that was kind of the process, you know, and it was full speed ahead, definitely full speed ahead, you know.
Yeah, I was curious if the process of filming these four shorts felt very different from filming a feature with Wes.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, it was very different because each one was unique. And it was kind of, the schedule was different because oftentimes, because the builds of the sets were so intricate, we would do one and then we might have some time off. And so I would come back here to LA and for like 10 days while they were building the set, and everyone would leave, you know, except for the art department who was building the set. And then I would go back to England, and then we would take, you know, depending on how much time we needed, we might need 2 or 3 days, or, you know, typically 3 days to go in, and then we could do our layout tracks and light it and get it all ready from our end. First, they have to build the sets, and then we come in and put our touches into it. And so it was a very unique way of working, and each one was different. And it was kind of fun because it was winter in England, and so I could be there for two weeks or whatever, come home for a couple weeks and go back to England. And I was flying back and forth quite a bit, but which is not something I've never done before. But it kind of gave you a break and a chance to kind of refresh your brain and then think about the next one, you know, and which is unusual because typically on a movie, once you start it, you know, it's a, you know, you go straight for months, you know, but this way we get little breaks between, and it was nice for me to be able to come home.
Yeah. Well, the films turned out so well, and your work is always so incredible. So again, Robert, I appreciate your time. Thanks for chatting with me today.
Thank you very much. That was a pleasure.
This is a terrific piece of information. This could change my life.
An extraordinary thing happened.
All at once, he sees through his own skin. Like an X-ray, only better, he sees everything. Henry was now almost certainly capable of making money faster than any other person in the entire world. Interesting.
His name was Henry Sugar. I think people ought to know a bit about what he has done for the world.
Well, Kasia, thank you so much for your time today. I love Henry Sugar, and I'm so excited to hear more about your work on the film. Appreciate your time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Henry Sugar was a really beautiful exploration with Wes. I mean, the story is so charming and so interesting. And we dove very quickly early on, and just when we found out that we're going to be working on this project, into intense research, because we always start with photographic research. And we shared that research, sent it back and forth to each other, and responded. That's how usually my process with Wes looks like. We share a lot of visuals with each other and respond to it. And that's how this process started. And that's how the building of the character starts. So after we have and Wes, as we all know, he's a master of visual language. And very often in his scripts, there is already so much information about the visual direction. So it's about carving out the details and finding out the precision of that language. And Wes, the last time I worked with him was years ago on Moonrise Kingdom. And in the meantime, we both became, I think, so much more experienced in our crafts. And so it was really fun to meet again. And the communication was that much faster and that much more exciting and immediate. And that's the fun part of working with Wes. It's working in a room of masters, and you have to really, you really have to be ready to speak that language. And it's really interesting and fun.
And obviously Wes Anderson is known for this heightened reality. How do you get started? I'm curious to hear more about your research and the pieces that you used as references for Henry Sugar.
I think that the heightened realities, it's my job and all the creatives to understand Wes's vocabulary that comes with Wes's territory, that heightened reality. I think that if sometimes we try to put this verbal language to something that is very non-verbal, it's Wes's world. And after you study, after you are familiar with it, it is very clear of what that world is. To me, visually, it's very clear. And it is, you take photographs and film references and book references and descriptions and sort of molded to his world, to this heightened reality, to this, his color palette. It's the communication that happens between Wes and the production designer and the director of photography. And we all know which territories we're exploring with Wes. It's people ask me, was it 50s? Was it 60s? Was it? And I was like, it was Wes's world. There's references that we all understand, but in his world, those references are taken from multiple different sources. That's the fun. And I'm not going to reveal all the sources where we take the inspiration from. That's the secret, you know, of communications, but we transform it to this timeless language, because in the end, it's a very timeless story and a timeless language. And I think you cannot pinpoint completely. There's aesthetic. There's probably more driven by 60s aesthetic, late 50s, early 60s aesthetic, but it's not a direct quote by no means. It transforms to a language that reflects the story. So it's Wes's language, very much informed by the story that he's telling. So each time it's a completely different vocabulary, and each time it's very different dimension, but each time it's extraordinarily specific and very detailed and extremely precisely executed. And sometimes Wes has a full-blown visual reference already ready, and then he does those animatics where he portrays a lot of the sketched-out processes, and we, the creatives, we respond to his very precise direction. It's so interesting for me to experience this process, because at the same time as I was working on Wes's film, on the story of Henry Sugar, I was working also on Pale Blue Eye, which was an amazing film set in 1865, and then went on to Gilded Age, which is completely, each one of them had completely different vocabulary and completely different scale. So it's a different prism and a different perspective how you create those characters, and it's a different attention to what ends up on the camera in what dimension. But I think that's the privilege of making movies. That's the beauty of making movies, that we get to travel between so many different worlds and experience that intimately, the details of each of those characters and each story. And then, of course, there's the incredible actors who join the company, and the collaboration when it gets expanded to the collaboration with the actors, it becomes a whole other dimension of finding the characters and the precision. But at the same time, Wes is so extraordinary, specific in his direction, that we all know where we're going. We all know the direction where we're going.
Mm. Yeah, and you can feel that when you watch the film. I want to hear about some of the specific pieces. I mean, it's not often that right in the dialogue of the film from the very beginning, the movie tells you something about the character's clothes, but it does here in Henry Sugar. Dahl describes Henry Sugar right from the beginning as paying a great deal of attention to his clothes, going to an expensive tailor, so on. How did you, find that style for Henry Sugar, and were they original pieces that you created? Were you finding pieces that fit this look?
Majority of the pieces were custom-made, bespoke pieces that we made for Henry Sugar, which we worked with a tailor from Savile Row, Chris Kerr, who is an incredibly skilled tailor, British tailor. And yes, it was all custom made. Majority of the pieces were custom made. There were a few knits that were purchased, but they all came from very specific British shops. That's what gives this character this very specific bespoke look. And that's the stage from research, references, creating character, choosing the fabrics, and then tailoring. And tailoring, it's a world of dialogue with a tailor and several fittings and finding the perfect shape from the original idea to how things fit on the body. That's the magic of bespoke tailoring, when things are shaped and molded, sculpted on the body. Mm-hmm. And extremely skillful tailors, they do know how to read every curve of the body. And that's the difference between bespoke tailoring versus tailoring off the rack. We all have, our bodies have different shapes. Our shoulders are different, bellies are different, the backs are different. So off the rack suit, if some people are model ready sizes that they get lucky and those suits might fit with alterations, but the bespoke tailoring gives the opportunity of this perfect tailoring for specific body. And that's what we knew. That's it, in a way, it's a very quiet language, because theoretically you wouldn't even know that that's what demands this perfection of tailoring, because the suits is supposed to look like it fits. And that's that quiet elegance. That's what the British quiet elegance is. Those suits fit very well, fit the bodies. And I think that that's that inner elegance. And it's all about finding the proportion of the lapel, of the shoulder, of the length of the sleeves, of the length of the jacket, the width of the pants. Those are the details that go into an extremely well-studied tailoring. And it's always the biggest challenge of every film production is to bring that kind of reality to screen, because traditionally those bespoke suits take months, and we have to in film timeline, we have so much less time than the real world of bespoke tailoring. So it is always a dialogue with a few tailors who are willing to work with film schedules.
Another specific piece that I'd love to hear about is Roald Dahl's outfit as well. You have Ralph Fiennes in sort of these cozy riding clothes. I'm curious if that was inspired by actual reference material from Dahl himself, or was it entirely just a creation?
It was absolutely inspired by Roald Dahl look that was well photographed and very well researched by us, and very much referenced in the style of the clothing that Ralph Fiennes is wearing. And it's definitely a reflection of, it's not identical, because it never works fully to do something identical. You have to be inspired by the real pieces, but allow yourself to create a new language of the film. And I think that there's a slight shift. Not all the pieces are identical from the pieces that Roald Dahl was wearing, but they are definitely deeply inspired by the reality of what Roald Dahl was wearing. Yeah, there were a bunch of really amazing photographs of Roald Dahl that were the source of the inspiration.
Amazing. And another big moment in the film is as Henry is sort of crafting his plan to win at all these different casinos. He needs a lot of different costumes to make that happen. You know, you have him in a dress and different things like that. Tell me about designing some of these looks. And I'm curious if there were other looks that you tried out for fun that didn't make the final cut.
We had the most fun session with Benedict Cumberbatch. It was actually magical, because that's who he is. He's magic man. I mean, it's like Wes gave us direction of what it needs to be, and then we went off with trying those looks. And it was just 2 days of just pure fun of creating those characters. And we had way more options than what ended up on the screen, for sure. And I have actually this amazing run of pictures that we took during Benedict's experimentation with the characters, when he was so quickly slipping between all the different personas and truly creating within the fitting room, creating characters that were unrecognizable from each other. So you couldn't tell that it was Benedict just changing. I mean, he's so talented and he's so committed and he's so fully immersed in discovering the personas. And it was, I think this was an opportunity for him to have just this instantaneous, quick fun.
Amazing. Were there any of those other looks that you really kind of wish had made the final cut?
I think that there was quite a few, several looks, but there was, we already knew that we had more than enough for that sequence, but they were for sure fun, super fun experimentation, the tourist and the lady and the priest. It was definitely fun.
Towards the end, when Henry starts to, you know, he's throwing money in the street, he wears for the first time this bright orange outfit, something completely different from what he's been wearing for the rest of the film. Clearly, there was some specificity to that color. What can you tell us about this shift that his character undertook and how that played out with the costumes?
I think that it's Wes's pulse of the film. That's what that color did. That became a shift in the pulse of the rhythm of the film. And sometimes costumes work, give that depth to the rhythm. And I think that's what it was about.
Well, Kashi, you have worked in so many styles and periods across all of your projects, so many Gilded Age, like you said, so many others. Is there a genre of film that you haven't gotten to work in that you would love to experiment with?
Well, I think that for me, the incredible privilege that I've had in my life, in my professional life, was to be part of amazing stories. And when I started, I realized that if I love the story, if I'm engaged in the story, I can do a really good job. And I never thought that it will add up to something, that approach, but it actually did. And I think that I hesitate. It's never been driven by a period of clothing, because it could be the most incredible period of clothing. If the story is boring, nobody's going to watch it. And we know I'm not going to be engaged making it. But I'm always so curious, what is that next story that I'm going to be invited to be part of? What is that storytelling that is going to engage me in for 6 to 8 months of my life? That's the part, that's the beauty of the working on film. We get to know stories so intimately, and we get to know the world so intimately that it takes you for a journey that you just never expect that, you know, it's like, and you never know what is behind the doors. Like every New Year's Eve, I'm like, what is going to happen this year? What is going to be the adventure of this year? Or at the end of the year, because right now I know what I'm going to be doing for the next few months, but that's always the mystery. That's always that most exciting part about film magic.
Absolutely. And we can't wait to see what you do next. Kasia, again, thank you so much. I really loved your work in the film, so thanks for chatting with me today.
Thank you so much. Very appreciated. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Daniel Howitt's interviews with the cinematographer for the Oscar-nominated short film, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, Robert Yeaman, and the film's costume designer, Kasia Walika Mamon. The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar is now available to stream on Netflix and is up for your consideration for the Oscar for Best Live Action Short Film. You have been listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you'll get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you all so much for listening, as always, and we will see you all next time.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.